Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Flute Talk podcast. I'm Nick.
And I'm Amélie.
Hey, Amélie, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. We had some technical difficulties yesterday, but today we're smooth, I think, sailing. No more weird warping sounds. If you're having any problems with the sound, just let us know in the live chat. If you have questions on the live chat, just be sure to let us know, and we will try to answer them. But for now, we have a couple questions from Reddit and from Facebook, and some from YouTube. We're going to start off with a question from Reddit, though. So Iowa28 says, so I'm a flutist, but I've been asked to play piccolo in an upcoming concert, but I don't usually play it. Is there anyone, or can you, supply me with some tips on embouchure technique and more?
Okay. Well, yes, we have made a video about piccolo recently. You can watch that. If not, what I would say is piccolo is a smaller instrument with a smaller aperture. So you have to focus the airstream very well on the embouchure plate and make everything a bit smaller. And you have no choice but to support if you want to have a good sound on the piccolo. So you have to use the muscles that are all around your belly and even in the back. Yeah, I was thinking about something yesterday. Well, I was doing yoga, and the teacher said to breathe in 3D, and I was like, wow, that's real. That's true. Sometimes we think of only breathing through the muscles in the front of our belly, but the lungs also, like, it's in the back as well.
Yeah, so they spread in the back. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, so using all those muscles around to push the air in a stable manner. I know people talk about the diaphragm a lot, but the diaphragm is a membrane. It doesn't, you can't control it, but you can control all the muscles, the respiratory muscles that are all around. And
yeah, that's just biology, right? You know, biology and science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So use all your space, the back as well, like 3D, and keep it just, yeah, all the time. And then the rest is just smaller, like open the lips a bit smaller, open them less, I guess. Make a smaller hole with your lips and make sure the airstream is very well focused, like in a V shape on the plate. And then, yeah, go from a low register and go higher and higher, and try to keep a good sound quality, and think about how you support the air. And then for articulation, it's quite cool articulation on the piccolo. I think it's easy to articulate well on a piccolo because of the crisp of it, and you know, everything is smaller, so you go toot 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 toot. And what do you think about that? Articulation, yeah, on the piccolo is not a big issue. It's usually easier.
Yeah, articulation for me, I think it's more obvious, because even with such little energy, as long as it's supported, it does what it does, yeah. I always feel.
So but if you over... As long as it's supported. As
yeah, as
said.
Long as it's supported, yeah, to a basic level, and then to a level that sounds good. Mm-hmm. Because if you do too much, it becomes so... It cuts through absolutely everything, and a lot of conductors or a lot of... Most of the time, piccolo's played in an orchestra or in a marching band. But in an orchestra, you don't want it to really be the soloist if it doesn't need to be, you know, even if it's just part of the color. So putting too much energy can just cut through everything, which is, yeah, sometimes, yeah, you don't want that too much.
Yeah, you have to be able to control the energy you're, yeah, putting in.
And yeah, back to the breathing thing, I think the 3D thing is great too. I always think the lungs are a balloon, and a balloon doesn't just fill up in one direction, half of it. Like, you know, it fills up in all directions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know what I mean? Exactly. It's a great image. Yeah. And what you said about the piccolo, we're going from one thing to the other, but it's all linked.
Yeah, it's all linked.
About the energy and everything. In a way, I would just... What I did when I started the piccolo is I would do pretty much the same exercises I did on the flute.
Yeah, they don't
so
really
long
change.
Long notes, all those things, so I get comfortable on it. Even when I play alto flute, I do long notes on the alto flute. I do all those things. I practice a bit with a tuner, because the tendencies of the instrument can be a little bit different, so practicing with a tuner can show you, oh, on my piccolo, these are the notes that are high and low. It's not necessarily the same as on your flute. And Yeah, really do the same exercises, but everything's smaller. It's not, I think it's, you can be calm about it because it's not that difficult to go from one to the other, I think. Maybe put a little ear, a little plug in your ear, especially the right ear.
Oh, earplugs, yeah. And maybe even give earplugs to the person next to you. You know. Yeah. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I would just, in addition to that, yeah, just say, like you said before, most exercises tend to be identical to the flute, like long tones, articulation exercises, and, you know,
octaves
also,
or
yeah, and listening to yourself, yeah, like recording yourself, and just, even if it's only like 30 seconds worth of stuff, it can tell a lot. It can tell, are you articulating enough? Are you supporting enough? And then you just make your adjustments, and then you try to maintain those adjustments to get a pleasant piccolo sound, because it's easy, but it's also, you have to be, I think you have to be even more aware than on the flute, because it's so easy to just play the piccolo, but you can also play it very, very, like if we were, like I was saying, cutting through other people's sound and really.
Yeah, that's why you can do long notes and you can play loud and soft and practice those things. Yeah, this way you can. If you do long notes, you can do 3x3 piano, and then you do five notes at a time, and you do forte, and then you know, you can mix it up the same way you would practice on the flute.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a great question. Next question, we have another question from Reddit, from Dead Pro. They just got a flute a few days ago and would like some tips on how to remember finger positions. I've got a little background in music, and they say, I'm teaching myself in jazz piano. Everything in piano has a logic to it. The chord shapes and the fingerings are all very logical, and I like that. But how do I make sense of flute fingerings?
Okay. Well, there's a logic to it.
Absolutely. I think there's absolutely logic to most of those things. And I know we have a video about it, and I mentioned that inside the reply to watch that video first, about flute fingerings and how to read flute fingerings.
Yeah, and I think in my beginner videos, like I made some videos for beginners, I explained the logic a little bit of the
fingerings. Are great videos, absolutely, yeah.
So,
those are
the flute is a tube with holes in them, and holes in the tube. I say obvious things when I teach. So, the holes make the air go out of the tube. So if I don't do anything, the tube is that long, you know, for people who see, but
absolutely,
the tube becomes as long as from the head to the first open hole. So that's pretty much it. So when I put another finger, I block one more hole, so the tube becomes a little bit longer and longer and longer, and then it brings me lower notes. So if I start with a C, the tube, the first place where the air gets out is behind where the B key is.
Uh-huh.
And then when I close this one, the tube gets a bit longer, and then I play a B, and then I put another finger, and it's an A, and G, and F, and E, and D. So whenever I make the tube longer, the sound gets lower and lower. And then I use harmonics to play higher notes with the same fingering. So I'll just demonstrate it, I guess. I'll go from C, and I'll just add a finger at a time and go down to D. I can even add this one and do the C. And then I can do the same thing with the same fingers, just going one octave higher by blowing differently. And that's it. Only on the D here, I have to raise my index finger, but apart from that, it's pretty much the same thing. Then in the third register, you have harmonic fingerings that are a bit more, you know, two holes open, two closed, and all those things, but that's what I would start with for the logic of the fingerings. Maybe you want to add something?
It's pretty self-explanatory. Well, the way you said it, I mean. I would just encourage you to, I know there's the big problem on the internet is that there's so much information and so many of us, which is a great thing. They do a lot of research self, you know, people who are doing flute playing, you know, they're self teaching themselves, and even professionals and even people who have lessons, teachers, you know, finding flute fingering charts. There's so many of them. And a lot of them I've seen have a problem. And a lot of people have been saying that there's a lot of alternate fingerings instead of the fingerings that you need. So it makes things confusing a little bit for some people. I don't know if this is the case for this person, but lately I've been looking into that. And because I want to make a flute fingering chart that is simple, and then make an alternate fingering chart and not mix them together. That way,
that way it's clear.
Like, these are the ones you should know first. And then if you're in a problem, or if you have a trill that doesn't work, like F sharp to E, you know, those are that's deadly. That it just doesn't work. But then there is a trick fingering for it that makes a trill super fast and super easy.
Or if you want to play your G sharp third octave a bit lower,
absolutely.
What you do, but you have to start with the real fingering.
Yeah. So yeah, that's what I would say. I would say, it's watch those videos. Watch our video particularly, because I think it's pretty clear. And that's a great question, though. It's good to know. So we're going to jump to YouTube now, YouTube comments. And we have one comment about flutter tonguing by Mula Raikar. Do the lips vibrate when we flutter tongue? And what is the feeling at the lips?
Nothing really goes on at the lips when I flutter tongue. It's really in the throat. And that's it. I just play as normally as possible, and I just add that.
Yeah, the sensation in the lips isn't really.
That's it.
Yeah, isn't really
there's
present.
Nothing going in the lips going on. The lips don't work that hard when you play the flute.
Yeah, generally, they really don't. Yeah, generally they shouldn't.
Don't work
yeah,
very hard. I think.
Yeah, I think the moment you start putting a lot of tension on the lips, you get a lot of issues with sound production.
Yeah, because I think, well, we don't have that much control over those muscles, and it's
and there's thousands of them in the lips, you know, thousands of little individual.
Yeah, when you start moving too much, I guess you lose consistency, maybe.
Absolutely.
It's difficult to replicate the same stuff all the time, so I try to be more stable, and the upper lip practically doesn't move, the lower lip a little bit sometimes to go from one register to the other. Or to work with the intonation. So if I want to bring the note a bit higher because I'm in the end of a phrase and I know it's going to go low, I might use my lower jaw. But yeah, it's when you flutter tongue, the lips don't do much. Don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, that was a great question.
Involved.
Yeah, they're not involved, exactly. If you have any questions or comments in the... if you're watching live, you can definitely ask a question in the live chat, and we'll answer those as efficiently as we can. Another comment here we have, a little blast from the past, a little bit early on in your early life, Lily, and maybe I could even answer that too, but when you started out playing the flute, what flute did you have, and when did you learn... Oh, well, the question really is what did you start with when learning the flute, and what did you end up with, and how did these instruments compare?
Oh, okay, just instrument-wise.
Yeah, just your instrument, when you first started out.
When I first started, I was in school, so they gave me a Yamaha, I think 2-something, you know.
221, probably, the most standard flute of all.
Yeah.
The most famous.
I think it was closed holes and, you know, super basic. Then my parents bought me a Yamaha 484, I think. And I had it for a couple of years. And then my teacher said, well, maybe a new flute would be a good thing. Because, she felt I was getting a bit... I couldn't progress as much with my old flute anymore. So we went and bought a Sankyo Artist. I think that model doesn't exist anymore. It's another name.
Yeah, they used... it's now it's something else. But there's definitely... Yeah, you're right.
And then I really liked the mechanism and everything, but I thought, well, maybe I can find a head joint that suits me better. So I started looking around, but really just, I wasn't looking that much, but I was like, whatever, I'll try sometimes if I fall in love with something. And then I found a Wimberly head joint, and it was for me. So now I play with that.
Yeah, and that's David Wimberly, who was based in Nova Scotia, I think, yeah?
Yeah.
So what did you notice? What was the biggest difference between the transitional instrument?
Well, when I started having my 484, my Yamaha, I guess what was different, first I had open holes.
Mm-hmm.
And also, it's a flute that's a bit better, you know, so mm-hmm. my sound, everything was easier, I think, and the mechanism, because also it was a new flute. The other flute was a beat-up flute from the school.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that helped. And then when I changed again, I remember more because I was a bit older. I thought my flute was vibrating in my hands more, maybe because of the metal. I felt it was more...
Yeah, because nickel silver vibrates a lot more brighter. Like the cheap, not cheap, but like the standard student flutes, they're an alloy together of copper and silver. It's like a mix, you know. Mm-hmm. And those tend to be the most brightest flute sounds. And and then when you add silver, it starts to make it a little less bright. But then there's a lot more middle in silver, more. And then gold.
I felt
and
like
all those
physically
things.
That it was vibrating in my hands.
Ah, okay.
You know that?
Right.
That's what I felt at the time. And also, yeah, I had more projection. I had more, the mechanism was amazing. And then when I changed the head joint, I was able to do more colors. And also, some of the difficulties I had were counterbalanced by my head joint.
Right.
Like I found the one that, like Cinderella's shoe or something.
Yeah, that suits the flute. The flute suits the suitor or something like that.
Yeah, because we all have our tendencies. So if
absolutely.
Yeah, if your sound is a bit darker and you want something more, how do you say? You said that earlier.
Suitor.
No.
Brighter.
Bright.
Bright. Yeah.
You might look for something that's gonna bring that in your sound.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe your neighbor sounds amazing on a flute that, or on a head joint that would just bring out too much of your own tendencies already. Maybe you want to balance it out with something that's, you know, going in the other direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great question. That's a great answer, yeah. Scott Brown, we have a question from Scott in the live chat. As a new flute player, when does one know it's time to remove the open hole plugs and play with open ones?
Okay.
Well, you can start with that one, and I can add to it.
Okay, well, you don't have to remove them. It doesn't really matter to leave them in. It doesn't really affect the sound that much. But if you do want to remove them, you just have to decide to do it and do it, you know?
Yeah.
I would start by removing the ones that are easiest. Like, I would remove one at a time, maybe. Or what you can do is remove all of them, and then you check and see which ones you don't close that well, and then you plug only those ones, and then you adjust from that. But yeah, I guess I would start with the index finger of the right hand, because it's quite easy to put the finger in the right spot. The only thing is, you'll have to adjust. Some people with closed holes or with the plugs, they play with the fingers too. Like the fingers are going overlapping the keys.
Yeah, you go over the keys.
They
your
go
fingers
over the
you
keys.
Go over about half an inch sometimes even.
Yeah, instead of the first phalange being over the key, it's like this second knuckles, you know. So maybe I would remove everything and bring it back. So, and then, you know, because even if you can't, your hand is a hole. You can't separate your fingers that much. So if your index finger is in front of the hole, the right, and the other fingers are too far, then it won't work. So just be careful to bring everything back to the right position, the whole hand. And then you can start removing one at a time. I would start with the index and then the middle finger and then the ring finger. And for the left hand, I would start by removing the middle finger and then the ring finger. Like, I would go from the thumb out. That's easier to remove them. What would you do?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, totally. Well, there's like different schools of thought, you know. I've heard people who also just who play with closed hole flutes, you know. It does promote good hand posture, open hold. It does indirectly does do that for you know, just like with clarinets. Clarinets have holes in there, and that promotes.
Yeah, the
right hand posture, or the posture that is decided upon by the fingering gods. But yeah, but there's also new flutes that come out now more than ever, and people also modify their flutes to fit their hands.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say, you know, those plugs are training wheels, I think it's kind of counterproductive to tell people that, but it also is wise to make sure you have a teacher telling you to keep your fingers on top of the keys instead of over the keys, because it just promotes bad technique and promotes more chances of accidents happening, and also just physical accidents. Like, you can have problems with your fingers if you have unevenness. Not much control. The technique is going to suffer.
Yeah.
All those types of things. But that's also saying that if you had a closed hole flute, doesn't mean you should have your fingers over at all either. It should still be as it would be if it was an open hole flute.
Yeah, it's just that sometimes it's...
Just some people like that type of sound. Some people like that type of security that if they don't...
Just sometimes when people don't have to close the holes, they just go over the
exactly.
key and they don't really notice.
And even with me, and even with some flutists, I know some as time goes by, sometimes we plug some of the holes. Like, I plug my F sharp key because my finger tends to slip all the time, no matter how hard I
and you go want the at result.
It
you don't
yeah we want the result. Nobody really cares.
No,
if you're
critiques don't see that from where they sit in the hall.
No and your fans and
no
people, anybody,
notice.
You know, but
they will notice if you sound bad.
Absolutely. Yeah, as long as you get the result that you are required, then that's great. But yeah, but to begin, obviously, as training wheels, and to promote good hand posture and hand health on the flute, those are great. Because most kids, and I'm sure, and most adults who start learning the flute, they tend to overlap and go over top of the keys. So that's it's a very interesting question. I think you should remove one at a time, not all at once, because I think... but not over a long stretch of time. Maybe after a day or two, you move one, see how it feels, and two or 3 days, and three, and then four.
Yeah.
Then, you know.
Maybe it depends on the people.
Depends on the person,
like,
but a general.
Some people stop smoking at once. Some people start.
Yeah, general rule.
Remove two cigarettes a day for a month. You know, I think I just took it all out one day, and I was like, okay.
Yeah, it works for
learning.
Some people like that too.
But
yeah.
You know, we're all different.
Yeah, we're all different. I mean, just as a general work of thumb, like, you can break those rules. Those rules are meant to be broken and meant to be modified and do. But I think it's an interesting thing. And like, originally, just the historical thing, and I think we've said this before in another podcast, is that those holes on the flute particularly were actually made, at least in the history books, it's cosmetic.
Yeah,
there was actually no science to it. It was actually just a way to sell more flutes, because the Paris flute makers, Louis Lot, and all these other types of flute makers were all trying to get people to buy their flutes. And so Louis Lot was like, and I think it was Louis Lot or even Rudolf Kart, I can't remember, one of those two, they thought, let's put holes in them, like the old classical way, so people kind of nostalgic or whatever, however they were thinking, the business model. But it sold flutes. It sold flutes much more than the competition across the street or across the city. And it was new. It was new. It was hip. And it stuck. It stuck forever.
I didn't think about that at the time, but
no.
It helps if you want to do Glissandos.
Yeah, like Glissandos. Yeah, they didn't know that was going to happen. Yeah. Right. And yeah. That's it. Yeah. And it led to the movement. If they didn't do that, perhaps, you know, even Ava Kigma and all those very, very interesting flute players and flute makers that make microtonal and all those things, I think maybe we wouldn't be where we are right now. Maybe mm-hmm. we'd be a bit delayed if those flute makers didn't want to make that, business decision.
You can also make almost quarter tones, you know, if you go. Let's say I go.
Right. Yeah, those are, that's a.
Sometimes it's, you can do little. Just by putting my finger on the hole or just on the ring, but not filling the hole. But that's like.
Yeah.
If you really like that type of stuff, I do. But yeah.
That's it. Well, we'll do one more final question. If there's any questions in the live chat, we'll definitely get to that as soon as we finish this one. If not, we will probably end the podcast, but that's okay. Yeah, so the question was... Okay. Where is it here? Okay, it's a long question. This person just bought a Nuovo flute, which is a plastic flute. It's like the Guo flute, sort of.
Yeah, that we reviewed, yeah.
Yeah. My goal is to have the flute as a hobby as well as become accomplished so my baby son grows up in a musical home. In 10 years, I should be not too shabby a player, right? Can anyone give me advice for picking up and learning how to play? I'm considering lessons from my local music store, but would love any other advice.
Okay. Well.
Yeah, I think general, I can start it off if you don't mind. Well, first watch our channel. Also, learning your scales first. I think a lot of people don't just figure out your basic scales, like F major, B flat major. A lot of stuff is written in that. Getting one of those and learning basic tunes like Mary Had a Little Lamb. All those types of things, you know, because it sounds like this person starting from the complete beginning, mm-hmm. especially by the choice of flute. They just want to kind of get into it, a little dip inside a flute. So that's a starting point. Yeah. Get there first. And then step by step, I think you can explore more
right
stuff.
About the scales, because sometimes I have beginner students that play for fun. And they're like, I don't want to do scales. And I always respect that in the first few months. And mm-hmm. then I try to come back with, yes, but, you know, if you do scales, especially with adults, because, you know, adults are more like, I'm not, but with kids, I'm like, you do your scales. But I bring it in a way where I tell them scales, major and minor, scales in thirds,
mm-hmm.
and scales arpeggios. And third, yeah. If you know those things, all tonal music, which is pretty much all the music you're going to play, it's 90% of the music.
Yeah, you'll be accomplished.
And then instead of seeing each note individually, you'll group notes because you'll be, oh, it's a D major scale. Oh, it's a minor arpeggio. Oh, you know? And your fingers are already know that, so you can learn pieces way faster than you are an accomplished musician. But, yeah, there's a lot of ways. But first, learn your fingerings slowly,
yep, fingerings.
One at a time, and work on your sound. And then you add, you're going to want to read music, so you have to practice that. Maybe
yep.
playing studies one a week so you can read a lot.
There's even super simple studies out there, like really, really basic studies from yeah. Altez and stuff like that, that makes you just want to learn the basics of notation.
And a lot of them sound are nice melodies. We're going to make, we have to work on that a bit more. I'm a bit slow. We're making a... flute method, and we also want to make etude books.
Yeah, for super simple and also yeah. intermediate.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, because there's like even etudes
that
are
levels, you know?
Yeah, different levels. Absolutely. I always think about the Moyes book, the simple melodies.
Yeah.
You know, two lines.
And it's so good to do those things because then you read a lot of music. Then
yes,
the more you learn, it's not just about playing a piece. Working on it hours and
yeah,
hours
absolutely.
And never being satisfied with it because you don't even have the the skills to play it.
You're so right.
You
yeah.
know, if you know your, if you learn your, I think it's in a simple flute by
Debost. Michel Debost.
He says he encourages his students to practice. Well, he doesn't teach anymore, but when he wrote it, that he encourages his students to practice a lot of scales and learn a lot of music, because that's how they're gonna be good, you know, learning your basic words.
Mm-hmm. Learning the language.
Learning the language, not just practicing one piece for 6 months. Really going through a lot of material, I think, is helpful. You also want to play it well, but take stuff that's the right level for you, so it doesn't take you too long to learn it, and then move forward from that. I think it's more efficient than taking something very difficult, and it's all different, you know. I say that, but as a teenager, I loved having big challenges. I used to tell my teacher, "Oh, I want the biggest challenge this year. I'm gonna learn this," and he would give me a piece that was way too hard for me, and at the end, I would play it. But I was also in a music program where I was playing the flute every day in band. So it's a bit different from an adult who's just practicing. So really, it depends on each person, the time they have to put in. Because if you already play an hour a day in band and then you practice an hour at home, of course you're going to go to get good faster.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a teenager, what else do you have to do? I didn't clean the house. I didn't do much, you know. So I just practiced my flute. But for an adult, I would say those would be good.
But it's a great analogy. Yeah, it's a great analogy, though. The thing about Debose is, but it's like you can put that towards exactly like how you learn a language. You learn how to write it. You learn how to make sentences. You know how to eventually learn how to write a story or write a short story. But also, in addition, learning the masters, reading the masters. It's like reading, you know, learning music, learning all the scales, learning how to play all those things. And then you go and learn the masters, like Prokofiev. You read all those things. You read those musics. It's having that ability to read and play the masters. And then,
but at one point, you also want to learn pieces well so that you
that's
can
what
perform
I mean, yeah.
them and all,
that's
all those
it,
things.
That's
but
it. That's exactly it.
Yeah. But if you take pieces that are the right level for you, you'll attain that.
Yeah,
quite fast, so you can learn more of them instead of learning one or two a year, you know.
Yeah.
Because
I find the problem is that there's so much information, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, there's so much information out there on the internet for people to find things like you know, Royal Conservatory, all these types of different lists, and sometimes the lists, they don't match with other lists, and then people get confused.
Yeah, that's why I want to make something that's really step-by-step with, you know, levels, and you go from this level and then you learn those scales and those exercises and those studies and all those things. And then you go to the second level and you have another set of things
to accomplish. Yeah.
And at the same time, you can read rhythms and read notes and because it's not that easy when you don't have a teacher who sets those things for you to do it by yourself when you don't know where to look.
Yeah, now we live in the self-taught world now so much, and it's more relevant than ever. Yeah. But I feel that
to do something that's really
Exactly. So I think definitely something for us that we're going to be putting out soon. It's going to be pretty interesting. One final question, last one, and we'll end the podcast. It's guy Scott Brown again over on the YouTubes. Have you ever desired or enjoyed playing Native American flutes, being traditional metal flute players? Are they very different sounds? But he's curious, have we ever tried any ethnic?
I never tried any. I have a Baroque flute, a traverso.
Yeah. And we also have a crystal flute as well. We have a crystal flute. And we have a couple of flutes in D that are like shakuhachi, but not really shakuhachi.
Well, I had a student who was from China and went in China, visit her family, came back with a flute, and I have a little fingering chart and stuff, but I was not very good at it. I would need more time to work on it because it was different.
Mm-hmm.
The embouchure was different. It was completely another thing. But I never tried I remember looking online and being, oh, that looks interesting. I should buy one and try it, but nope.
The
I
forward, yeah, the forward playing one, the ones that kind of look like a recorder, the Native American ones. That's the ones that I think are front facing instead of side facing.
I think so. Yeah, but I think they so. Still use the same type of embouchure technique as our flute.
Right.
Because they
perhaps yeah.
It's open. It's not like a recorder.
No, I don't think so. I think you're right. Yeah, it's an open embouchure.
Like
I think too.
Yeah. It's open too, I think. Shakuhachi, the Japanese
yes,
flute.
That is true, yeah.
But it's a bigger hole and it's a different angle.
Yeah. Well, I would definitely like to try some out eventually in the future. Like there's cool. always I never got like just thought I'm a metal flute player, so I'm just going to play metal flute, you know. I'm not
No, it's not how it is. It's just time,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. An opportunity and stuff like that and be curious. Yeah.
Yeah, an opportunity. I never went to a place where they had it. I would have had to order it, like
right.
So I guess
right.
Maybe it's opportunity.
Yeah. Well, that was a great question to end on. We do this every other week, and so if you're watching this when it's not live, be sure to check it out next. In fact, it's going to be next. I believe probably next. The 18th after your concerto, and we'll be in New York City. So I think we'll do a New York edition Flute Talk podcast.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah, we're going to definitely do it at the, we'll be
preparing reviews.
Yeah, we're going to be recording some reviews for the Flute Center of New York. And if you're listening to this and you want a flute or buying a flute or buying a piccolo, definitely go and check them out and use the code TFC. You can get free shipping domestically in the United States. To try out up to 3 instruments, to try them out and see which flutes suits you, right? Like the Cinderella analogy you said before.
Yeah,
you got to try a lot of flutes.
And I think you have a 10-day trial instead of 7 days.
That's absolutely
with that
correct.
Code TFC.
Yeah.
And isn't there another thing?
There's a couple other things, but you can definitely find out all that information by either contacting them, Emily at the Flute Center of New York, or you can go on their website at flutesforsale.com. And you can call them as well.
We made a video about our association with them. So you can watch that video where we explain everything about it. So you use that code and it gives you little perks.
Yeah.
And
so that's what we'll be. Yeah, we'll do the flute podcast there in New York City on the 18th of November. So that's the next time we'll do the Flute Talk podcast. But next week we'll probably do a practicing with Emily session again just before your concerto. Or maybe even after. Or maybe even after. Or maybe on the Sunday. Probably on the Sunday.
Because on Saturday, I'll be focused on that. Because I play the concerto, but I also play in the orchestra.
Yeah.
So it's a big
You're a machine. You're a machine. You're a flute playing machine. Yeah, so be sure to check that out. If you haven't subscribed to the channel, be sure to go and jump on the YouTube, or if you're watching on YouTube, and subscribe. And you'll get and hit that little bell so you can get all the notifications for us, especially for the live streams, because we make them events and you can see and set a reminder for yourself that we will be on a line live to talk and answer all your questions. So this is Nick
and I'm Edie,
and we will talk to you guys next time. See you later.
Thanks for listening
and watching.